From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, U.S.-Egyptian relations in a Trump administration. Our guest, Amer Hamzawi, former member of the People's Assembly in Egypt, to which he was elected in the first parliamentary elections after the historic January 25, 2011 uprising. He is now a senior associate in the Middle East and Democracy and Rule of Law programs at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He served at this same prestigious Washington-based think tank from 2005 to 2009. He has also served as the research director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, Lebanon. He holds academic appointments at the American University in Cairo and Cairo University and was recently a visiting scholar at Stanford University. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi was among the first foreign leaders to call and congratulate Donald J. Trump on his victory in the U.S. presidential elections. We'll be talking with Amer Hamzawi about how the election of Mr. Trump might affect U.S.-Egyptian relations on the domestic and foreign policy fronts, as well as relations with the greater Middle East. Amer Hamzawi joins us from a studio at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Amer Hamzawi, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to join you.
Well, Amer Hamzawi, as you know, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi was among the first foreign leaders to call and congratulate Donald J. Trump on his victory in the U.S. presidential elections. And of course, while he and his supporters welcomed the news of Trump becoming the 45th president of the United States, many of Egypt's liberals and pro-democracy activists expressed shock and anguish on social media. In the Washington Post, an article said that an engineer who had joined the 2011 uprising in Egypt said, quote, "How can you hope for freedom when the most powerful man in the world doesn't believe in our democracy?" How did you take the election of Donald Trump? How do you read that?
Well, with an eye on Egypt, I completely agree that Trump's election is going to signal to Mr. Sisi and his government that they can go ahead and do more of, unfortunately, what they have been practicing throughout the last 3 years, since 2013, since Mr. Sisi performed a military coup and removed the elected president, Mohamed Morsi. Trump's election signals to Sisi and his supporters that they can go ahead and do more of their human rights abuses and violations and repression, simply as the quote you were referring to suggests, because the most powerful president of the most powerful democracy on earth doesn't care much about the rule of law, doesn't care much about human rights, doesn't care much about freedoms, especially when it comes to countries away from the U.S. Secondly, I believe the election victory of Mr. Trump signals to Mr. Sisi that, well, the populism he represents, Mr. Sisi represents, and his anti-democratic vision is becoming a global phenomenon. It's no longer a phenomenon confined to Egypt or confined to some Arab countries. It's everywhere on the rise. It's on the rise in Europe. And this is going to be looked at by Mr. Sisi and his supporters as a confirmation of the course they are doing. Very similar to the way Mr. Putin is reading the election results and the Chinese government is reading the election results and so on and so forth.
Speaking of Mr. Putin, Amer Hamzawi, President-elect Trump has suggested a recalibration, actually, in favor of Russia in the region, away from Shiite-dominated Iran, and that could potentially benefit the Sunni Gulf states and Turkey and Egypt as well.
Well, I beg to differ. I do not believe that recalibrating U.S.-Russian relations is going to impact positively on Middle Eastern countries, be it we are referring to the Gulf monarchies or country like Egypt, or in fact, if we move away from looking at governments and looking at Arabs across the region, this is not going to benefit any one of us for different reasons. For one, Russia is an ally of Iran, of the Islamic Republic in Iran, as we are seeing it in Syria, and the Russian-Iranian alliance is an alliance based on crushing the popular uprising and crushing not only radical Islamists, who I believe should be pushed against militarily, but even the civilian population demanding an end to the butchery implemented by the dictator of Syria, Mr. al-Assad. Secondly, Russia does have clear strategic interests when it looks at the region. It's interested in finding back to its military presence, which used to be the case back in the 1960s, 1970s, and Egypt is one of the targets. Russia has been selling arms to the Egyptian government increasingly in the last 3 years. Russia is interested as well in finding ways and means to basically drive out the U.S. from the Middle East. Look at what's happening not only in Syria, but what's happening elsewhere across the region. Egypt is a case in point. So I don't see the recalibration of American-Russian relations leading to any solutions, and definitely it will not yield a positive result to the misery happening in Syria. It will only lead to Mr. Assad staying in power, bloody ways and means, which Mr. Assad is facing his civilian population with, will continue undeterred by any international criticism.
Well, Almer Hamzawi, you do point up an important contradiction that many analysts have also underscored, and that is, you know, how can a potential Trump administration that wants to curtail Iranian influence also align itself more closely with Russia and Bashar al-Assad without empowering Iran? Because we know very well that Iran is the main backer of the regime of Bashar al-Assad, who, as you rightly said, is butchering his own people and calling everyone a terrorist who just doesn't support him. So it seems that either Mr. Trump perhaps doesn't quite grasp this or is hoping he can smooth this over. So do you think then that the administration, once they get in, will see that they can't do both, because by backing Russia in the region, they are sort of implicitly supporting Iran?
President-elect Trump has been giving, in that regard, statements which are contradictory. On the one hand, as you've rightly mentioned, you cannot refer to working with Russia to find a solution, a just solution to Syria, simply because Russia is an integral part of what has been happening on the ground of the butchering of the civilian population, along with Iran, along with the Assad regime. In fact, it should be alarming when we hear al-Assad referring to President-elect Trump as a natural ally, and I'm quoting, as a natural ally in the fight against terrorism. This should raise alarm signals in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere about where the U.S. might be heading under an administration of President-elect Trump when it comes in office early next year. Secondly, what is really contradictory as well, and I believe that Trump people working on the Middle East should be looking at that, is the way the Sunni monarchies in the Gulf look at the role of Russia, look at the role of Iran, not only in Syria but in the region, and look, of course, at Bashar al-Assad's rule. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, key allies of the U.S., along with other Gulf monarchies, are opposed to the Russian role and to the Iranian influence in Syria and elsewhere. And working with Russia is bound to alienate the Gulf monarchies, which have been natural, in fact, the natural allies of the U.S. throughout the last years, if not decades. You can leave Syria aside and go to Yemen, where we see, and I'm not, of course, justifying bloody war, which unfortunately is being waged by Saudi Arabia, a Saudi-led alliance against the Yemeni population. But here, too, going along with Russia would mean going with Iran, which stands in Yemen against Saudi Arabia and the alliance led by Saudi Arabia. And these are the parties right now in military confrontation on Yemeni soil. So I believe they need to look at what is happening in the region and move away from accepting how dictators, how autocratic rulers, including Mr. Sisi, by the way, define what terrorism is all about, what terrorists and their identities are all about, because they will figure out that what these dictators group under the banner of terrorism and terrorists are sometimes voices of dissent, are sometimes civilian segments of the population demanding democracy and human rights and freedom. And therefore, coming back to our first point, once again, here the fears of voices of dissent, of Arab activists calling for democracy, that President-elect Trump will basically brush aside our concerns and will confirm autocrats in office, the way they implement their brutal policies, is an issue which is creating frustration among all of us.
And I think it's important to point out that many mainstream Republicans were quite alarmed at the prospect of the United States under a Trump administration collaborating with Russia, in particular Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona. He said that any attempt to so-called reset relations would be an unacceptable price for a great nation. We're taking a short break. We'll be right back.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOAnews.com.
Visit VOAnews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
Welcome back to Press Conference USA. On the Voice of America, we're talking with Amr Hamzawi, former Egyptian parliamentarian, now a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's a think tank here in Washington. Well, Amr Hamzawi, let's talk about your specific personal experience after the 2011 uprising in Egypt. It was a time of great enthusiasm, of hope for many in Egypt who rose up to express the desire for greater freedom. But unfortunately, things didn't turn out too well, even after Mohamed Morsi was elected president, although probably not the first choice of most liberal activists like yourself. Right. Nonetheless, he was removed in a military coup. Talk about your particular experience after the uprising and your reflections on how things have evolved.
Well, it's an agony liberal activists have gone through between 2011 and today. As you've mentioned, we were hopeful looking ahead after the removal of the former president, Hosni Mubarak, after his removal from office on February 11th, 2011. We were hopeful that Egypt can establish a democratic governance and can move ahead with regard to respecting rule of law and human rights, basic freedoms of our people. We tried. I was elected to parliament in parliamentary elections of 2011. We came to our first session in January 2012. However, we did not last in session for a long time. Parliament was dissolved by a ruling of the Supreme Constitutional Court. And when I look back at it, it was definitely motivated by political considerations, by the military establishment not wishing to see civilian politics rising to rule Egypt, which a country which has been ruled by military generals since 1952, since the free officers around former President Abdel Nasser performed the first coup in Egyptian history. We tried. We were sent home in June 2012. Parliament was dissolved. Presidential elections took place. Liberal activists, as you mentioned, including myself, did not wish to see former elected president Mr. Morsi to come in office, but he won. He won in presidential elections, and he started to perform his duties in June of 2012. A year later, the army performed a military coup and removed him. In between, a great deal of governing deficits and governing mistakes on the side of the Muslim Brotherhood and their former president, Mohamed Morsi. I was among those who called for early presidential elections as a democratic measure to end the crisis unfolding in Egypt. But of course, the army did not listen to anyone and took it its way, performed its military coup. And since July of 2013, Egypt is, regardless of what you see formally, parliament is in place now. Mr. Sisi was elected president almost 2 years ago. But apart from that aura of formal institutions performing politics, the truth is Egypt is being ruled by the military security complex, by the military establishment, security services, and the intelligence community, and voices of dissent have been crushed. I was banned from travel for a year right after the coup. The political reading of that is that I, as a liberal activist, I opposed the coup and described it as a coup, which is, in fact, a crime in Egypt if you describe it as a coup. I ended up being banned from travel. I was banned from performing my job as a professor at Cairo University as well. After my travel ban was lifted, and because as the authorities have been doing against many liberal activists, trumped up charges were moved against me. In my case, it's the so-called insulting the judiciary for a tweet which I wrote in which I criticized, and you may remember, and some listeners may remember, the Egyptian government pushed against NGOs and human rights organizations in 2012 and 2013, and they issued court ruling imprisoning several activists from Egyptian domestic organizations as well as international organizations. I wrote a tweet saying that this whole process, not the ruling, this whole process has been politicized. And for that, they pushed up, trumped up charges against me and threatened to start a process. And so I had to leave the country to find a safe place for myself and my family. I'm here in the U.S. since almost a year. And meanwhile, this process, based on trumped up charges I was just referring to, is moving ahead. And as many other liberal voices in Egypt, we are threatened by the potential of court rulings against us, not allowing us from going back home. But what has been happening is This military autocracy, this new military security autocracy in place, has closed off the public space. The spirit of 2011 is gone. Activists are either in prison or outside of the country. And they go on promising economic and social advancement to the poor population, not delivering and crushing all voices of dissent.
What is your critique of the Obama administration with respect to how they handled the aftermath of the uprising? Do you think the Obama administration could have done better, could have done something to have averted the fate that you faced?
Well, I mean, right now it's a difficult question to respond to, because with the prospects of a Trump administration coming in a few weeks' time, I believe all of us are going to look back at the Obama administration and its policies with regard to Egypt or elsewhere, even when it comes to American domestic politics, in a more favorable way than what we have been doing in the last years. But in objectivity, I would say the Obama administration has been reluctant to classify what happened in Egypt in July of 2013 as a coup. It was never referred to as a coup, and because they did not do so, and despite of the fact that the Obama administration did freeze the military aid package, you know, U.S. government offers the Egyptian military an annual military aid package of $1.2 billion from taxpayers' money. The coup did not get that identification in the U.S. from the administration. And although they did freeze the military aid package for a few months, they later released the military aid package. And of course, in releasing the military aid package, which was and is the main leverage the U.S. has over the Egyptian military, they enabled the military to move on and continue to basically backslide on the democratic transformation that was happening, unfolding after 2011, and take Egypt back to a place which is by far, by the way, worse than where Mubarak was prior to the uprising in 2011. Human rights violations, human rights abuses, including crimes such as extrajudicial killings, torture in prison, forced disappearances, and anyone can refer to international reports by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch, are by far worse than what we had prior to the uprising in 2011. The Obama administration was reluctant to use its leverage, its tool, vis-a-vis the Egyptian military to at least control their drive toward resuming and reestablishing an autocracy on the Nile. Secondly, and I do understand, the Obama administration got frustrated because freezing the military aid package for a few months did not yield any positive results. So they decided to give up on it and try to engage constructively with government of Mr. Sisi. But of course, this is a government which does not listen to any voice interested in human rights issues. Once again, this is a government which is not willing to entertain any rational discourse on the need to respect the rule of law and human rights and freedoms. The Obama administration did not do much after that. I believe they ignored Egypt. And this has been the overall policy of the Obama administration vis-a-vis different crises in the Middle East. Look at Syria, the inaction in Syria. The Obama administration brought us to where we stand right now with an inflated Russian role. Look at Yemen, a war where thousands of civilians have been killed since the war began over a year ago. And the Obama administration did not do much to stop its allies, the Saudi government, from waging its bloody war against the Yemeni population under the pretext of fighting the Iranian influence, and civilians pay the price. So the inaction of the Obama administration multiplied crises in the Middle East. However, once again, when I look at what is going to happen, most likely starting January 20th, 2017, I guess we will go back and look at even this inaction in a more favorable manner.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Amer Hamzawi, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he has a joint appointment in the Middle East and Democracy and Rule of Law programs. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Elham Ismail Zada from Kandahar, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the show, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Amer Hamzawi, you mentioned Mohamed Morsi, the former president, and of course the head of the Muslim Brotherhood. There's talk that President Trump might ban the Muslim Brotherhood, or rather declare them a terrorist organization, as they are considered in Russia and some other Arab countries. What is your view of this particular potential policy?
Well, designating any organization a terrorist entity in the U.S. is based on legal measures. There are clear legal measures which are attached to designating any entity as a terrorist organization, domestic or foreign terrorist organization. And what I can say at this point is I do hope that whatever the new administration might be pushing for, that Congress will stick to the legal measurement. The Muslim Brotherhood does not fit that definition of terrorist organizations. And if sanity will not come out of the White House in this regard, I hope Congress can stop the administration and its push for designating an organization, which I am not defending its platform, but I believe that we cannot label them a terrorist organization. I am not denying as well that there are splinter groups attached to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which have been pushed into violence in the last 3 years, facing regime repression and facing what has been happening. They have entered into a cycle of violence and counter-violence, but these are splinter groups. The main body of the organization is not violent, as far as I am concerned. So I am hoping for a due process based on the legal measurement. And that should go, by the way, for whatever the Sisi government is going to demand. Is the U.S. going to ignore, is the new administration going to ignore the main core of rule of law in the U.S. and submit to an autocratic administration in Egypt? This remains to be seen. But once again, we are not powerless. I believe a great deal of public debating is needed. And I hope that there are enough voices in Congress who will realize that this is not the right way for the U.S., for the most powerful democracy on earth, to go in.
Amr Hamzawi, there is also a campaign in Egypt to continue to curtail activities of NGOs and the parliament. According to my colleague Mohamed El-Shanawi, just approved a controversial law that spells more trouble for human rights organizations. What do you make of that?
It's interesting to look at the timing, by the way. Election results in the U.S. were announced on the 9th. Mr. Sisi congratulated President-elect Trump and was proud, according to the Egyptian press, which is closed and controlled by Mr. Sisi's cronies, was proud to be the first foreign leader to congratulate him. On November 10th, Egyptian authorities closed down the bank account of a leading Egyptian NGO working on torture cases, on human rights abuses and violations. 2 days later, the Egyptian government pushed into parliament a very problematic law governing NGOs. The law, which is still in place, dates back to 2002. This is a law which we always criticized as an autocratic law, which enables the government, exactly security services, to control NGOs, basically eating away their potential for autonomy and independence, especially when it comes to human rights organizations. But this draft law is by far worse than the 2002 law still in place. And this was pushed to parliament a few days after the election victory of Mr. Trump. Here you see the government of Mr. Sisi reading the international situation right. The main criticism to its autocratic handling of NGOs, be it with regard to harassing NGO activists, imprisoning some of them, creating judicial cases against them based on trumped up charges, the main criticism used to come from Washington, D.C., from the State Department, from the White House, and from Congress. Now, with Mr. Trump's victory, they no longer fear criticism coming from the White House or the State Department. They are right in reading the situation that not much criticism will come after that. So they are pushing their repression of NGOs forward, and I'm afraid that more of that is going to be seen coming out of Egypt in the next months.
Amr Hamzawi, another question from my colleague Mohamed El-Shanawi, who couldn't join me today. The military has dominated the political scene in Egypt since 1952. Do you see a near end to that?
Well, no, unfortunately not. It's in fact becoming more problematic in the last 3 years as opposed to the decades since the 1950s for different reasons. One, the economic and financial role of the Egyptian army is expanding, is on the rise. We are referring to the army as the biggest stakeholder in Egypt's economy. The political role of the army in alliance with the security services and the intelligence community is on the rise. Once again, you do not have any civilian blocks to check and balance the authorities of the army and the security intelligence services. Thirdly, here you have an army which is based on what Mr. Sisi has been doing, based on what his cronies have been saying. Here you have an army in place ruling and suggesting to Egyptians once and again that civilian politicians and civilian politics are not to be trusted, that the only entity which can deliver bread and butter to dining tables of Egyptian families is the army. The army is the only entity which can solve crises. And this suggestion, this populist suggestion of do not trust civilian politics, seems to be, up until today, powerful and popular in Egypt. The background is quite to the contrary, a failed set of economic and social policies, a country where poverty, unemployment, all macroeconomic and social indicators are going in the wrong direction. A government where getting money from outside is on the rise. So this is a government where economic and social and fiscal policies are not going right. However, the populist claim of we are the only game in town, only the army can solve it, still is popular with Egyptians. And the role of establishment of the army is on the rise, not approaching an end by any means.
Amr Hamzawi, as we close, listening to you, it sounds like we're going back to the era of the strongman. And here in the United States, other analysts may also come to that conclusion if Mr. Trump makes good on many of his proposed policies. So in that light, you wrote a book recently, Incomplete Transition to Democracy, in which you diagnosed factors that derailed this transition in Egypt. What do you think is needed to establish a real transition to democracy in Egypt? And are you hopeful that that may come to pass?
Well, I'm hopeful because Egyptians, considerable segments of the population, especially young Egyptians are not supportive of the autocracy. Young Egyptians do see where army generals are coming from, do see the vast authorities they have, the no checks and balances in place, do realize that a collapsed rule of law and terrifying accumulation of human rights abuses and violations is not going to take our country to the right place. So young Egyptians, students, young activists in the labor movement, in universities and elsewhere, have continued to stand up against the autocracy throughout the last years, in spite of its very heavy-handed repressive measures. We have over 50,000 Egyptians imprisoned, most of them detained, by the way, provisionally, even without any judicial cases against them. And the rest are facing trumped-up charges in most cases. And I'm not referring to those who are implicated in violence, because those need to be put on trial, of course, according to fair and just trial procedures. So young Egyptians are standing up against the autocracy. So in a way, I am hopeful because of them. When I look at the situation, however, right now, I believe we are witnessing autocratic buildup unmatched in Egyptian history. This government of Mr. Sisi has put in place laws, executive orders, policies which evacuate citizens from the public space. They use repression not to let citizens take to the streets once again and basically repeat what happened in 2011. They put in place laws, executive orders, which are designed, in fact, to surveil and pursue all voices of dissent. So they end up either in prison or they leave the country. So they do it, and they are on top of this repressive game, as it has been unfolding elsewhere. They read from an autocratic script. They are influenced by the Russian policies, by the Hungarian policies, and elsewhere. However, the only source of hope is related to young Egyptians who continue to resist. And the question, which is a homegrown and domestic question, is whether young Egyptians can push forward their platform and bring this regime to make concessions in a regional and international environment which is no longer attentive to Egyptian demands for democracy. The big change which will come with President-elect Trump is that the U.S. will basically stop talking about democracy and human rights. This is not his way of doing business, as he says, with Arab autocrats. He is attentive to a war on terror. He is attentive to demands when it comes to security and counter-terrorism cooperation. But democracy, rule of law, do not matter much for him. I believe even inside the U.S., they do not matter much. So the question will become, can young Egyptians continue to resist, develop their activism further, fashion new movements which will bring this autocracy to make concessions or will bring its end? I am hopeful, but it's going to be a very tough time ahead of us.
Amr Hamzawi served as a member of the Egyptian parliament after the uprising in 2011. Now he is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Amr Hamzawi, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
Thanks very much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Vasco Volorich. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.